Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. This show is sponsored by reclaimingtherepublic.org as well as republicreview.org. You are listening to the show that actually provides you with the process that will get the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. There is no other way. They're not going to do it on their own. And even if they kind of do it on their own, the next tyrant, the next people that come and replace those people who decided to do the kind of right thing, they will take us right back into the direction and even further as we've been ratcheted for closer and closer or for more forward towards communism. We are losing our ability to engage. When we lose it completely, when the states allow the federal government to set aside their constitution, when that happens, it's done. There's nothing else we can do. Because there is one thing we can do, and that is the what's the best way of saying it? I think that is when all hope is lost anyway, because that's when we'll actually have to pay the ultimate price once again for our liberties. We'll actually have to go into a true revolt. And the states do not have the technology or the weaponry or sophistication, anything like that, to be able to repel the military, the the standing armies that we are facing, as well as the globalist agenda. And as a matter of fact, those leaders, those corrupt politicians who allow that to happen, they're going to do everything they can to quell you. They're going to do everything they can to put down any type of insurgencies or any type of reaction that you're going to try to rally forward. I'm telling you, it's over at that point. And the best thing that we could probably all do is just pray that the Lord comes and saves us. Anyway, if you want to listen to this entire show but you cannot stream, you can always use our dial-in listen number, which is 605-562-4209 or 605-313-0599. Now, I do need to get back with Dr. Vile to come up with another conversation regarding immigration, the history of immigration in the United States, and where we need to go. And so he's written a good book on this. And so we will get him back on. Now, there's a lot of news out there. There's plenty of news out there. There's an overwhelming amount of information that we could drown ourselves in. That is the distraction. That news is not going anywhere. Are we going to finally arrest and make these pedophiles actually serve time? Excuse me. Or are we finally going to go after the criminals who have violated the laws within the federal government, or those politicians who have violated the Logan Act by reaching around this administration and trying to do deals and actually making deals with federal, or I should say foreign entities and foreign governments? Some states are doing that. Some states are violating the Logan Act because they're joining the accord of the Paris Climate Agreement. And in doing so, they are violating the Constitution and the constitutional laws. Anyway, we will get into some of that. We might actually have time for some of that today, but we didn't wrap up the myth of nullification in our last show, so we will be able to wrap it up this show. And so what we're going to do tomorrow is we're going to get into the Declaration of Independence, the original Declaration of Independence. I'm going to kind of walk through it. It may be a little cumbersome, but I would suggest that you do the same thing. you go through and read the exact wording that Jefferson had submitted for the Declaration of Independence and find out what was added, what was removed, and then you can start understanding why those things were removed. Because there was a placation, or a, what do you want to call it? There was this favorable allowance given to those slave states because they didn't want to seem like they were, you know, that bad as King George and so forth. And we'll get into that. And I think you're going to find this a real awakening in American history and a real insight to Jefferson and how he really felt about slavery. One of his quotes, one of the things he told, I believe it was to Madison, he said that we have the wolf by the ears. We can no longer hold it nor let it go, because this thing that they inherited called slavery was an untenable situation, or a situation that there was really no win, or they were recognizing that they had to do something more than just in slavery. They had to repatriate these good men and women who were forced into slavery back into Africa, and to put them in a place where the Africans would not entrap them and enslave them again and sell them somewhere else. Because that was big business. That was the way the machine was working in Africa. And so, as you know, history actually proved that the repatriation was very successful with a lot, but not enough and not all. I think that people should have been able to have their choice of being able to say, you know what, I want to stay here. I will put up with, you know, whatever potential racism and those types of things. But I want to stay here. I'll take my chances here. Or no, I'd be happy to go to Liberia. Anyway, without pondering too long on the topic, I'll just say that we will get into a lot of these things, these historical facts, when we get into it tomorrow. And I don't know if we can absolutely wrap it up tomorrow, but we will wrap it up this week. And then we have the marketing of the day, the news that's not going anywhere, or things that are not necessarily popping up in the news that you may need to know about because they're not telling you for a reason. Just like the Agenda 21 things that are happening, they are not telling you in the news, even in Fox News, they're not telling you these new laws and these things that are taking away your liberties and your rights. And there's a reason for that. But let me first grovel. We do need help. We need you to finally take a stand. We need you to actually stand up and become a part of the solution. Now, there's different ways you can help. If you're inclined to drink coffee, I would beseech you, I would request that you try Red State Coffee. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org. We have a link to the coffee beans and coffee grinds that are available on eBay. That is one way you can support a very patriotic company as well as Reclaiming the Republic. We would ask that you, once you've tried it, we would ask that you call back 425-270-5416, leave a message, and let us know what you think of Red State Coffee. We would love to have you help us advertise and help us promote this quality coffee. We also have the crowdfunding on GoFundMe. We would love to have your support for that. We're only looking to cover our costs of travel. And so with that, we would just ask that, you know, spare what you can. We're only looking, again, for covering our travel costs. As you know, it's really not about money, you know, but it takes money for a machine to operate, for a machine to work. So we do need your assistance. And one way you can assist is instead of throwing money into it, you can actually take on some of the work yourself. You know, become a philanthropist and donate your time and resources so that you can get involved in your county and state. If you want to get involved as a leader, if you want to get involved and help promoting Republic Review, the audit, and the entire process that gets the federal government into compliance with the Constitution, send me an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. You can help. You can be a part of the solution. Now, before I go into the, I got a little more obligatory things before I get into the interposition and nullification. And so we've got Constitution Day, you know, rapidly descending upon us with a 2-month mark. What are you going to do? Are you going to do anything to help bring and raise awareness of the Constitution, its importance, and so forth? Please, if you are, send us an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. We hope to start letting people know by the end of August, you know, how they can start planning for Constitution Day or Constitution Week and what the heck's going on around the country. Now, we want to thank you, more importantly, for tuning in. This is one way we can grow the show. We'd like you to actually be getting involved in this as well, because this is really what helps get the message out. We get into the details, we get into the facts, and we want you to share this show so that other people can actually tune in, get the message, and start understanding what the heck is going on and how to fix this problem. It's not impossible to do. We still have a little bit of time. With that, as you can tell with the music, I'm coming up on a hard break. So please stay tuned, and we will be right back with the myth of nullification and the facts on interposition. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue. And so yesterday, where we left off, I want to start off with the exact same citation that we ended with, so that you understand why it is so important to understand the Constitution in accordance with the ratification debates. Because the ratification debates was the process of where those who opposed the Constitution made all of these outlandish assertions. Those who were there from the Constitutional Convention and so forth. Now, I'll admit, there were some that, like Gary, as Mason, and others, who were really against it because they felt they needed a Bill of Rights. And I think that they articulated this back and forth very clearly. And I believe that it doesn't matter what those anti-federalists thought was the problem and or the case. The fact of the matter was that the states accepted the definitions and clarifications provided by those who were the proponents of the Constitution. Therefore, what those men said in promoting the Constitution were the words that are legally binding, because those were the words that were accepted in convincing the majority of the people of the states that this was the direction that they wanted to go on based on what they were told. So on top of that, this is what Madison said, because what ended up happening was a gentleman by the name of John George Jackson sent a letter to James Madison and said, I would like to have your notes on the Constitutional Convention, because he was looking at who was the gentleman that actually had the notes before him? And I'm trying to remember, because that gentleman wasn't at the Constitution after July 5th or something like that. And so, bottom line, they wanted to have Madison's notes to understand the Constitution more clearly as they were trying to, this was in the 20s. This was in 1821, in getting America past the next term, because by this point in time, we were really enjoying peace because we had finally won the Revolutionary War, which was extended into the 1812 War, where we finally had the Treaty of Ghent in getting Britain to finally recognize and abide by the treaties as much as possible. So anyway, Madison wrote back, and this is the quote that I provided you yesterday, but whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation or the republic or all of the states at the time of its ratification. No one felt this obligation more than I have done, and there are few, perhaps, whose ultimate and deliberate opinions on the merits of the Constitution accord in a greater degree with that obligation. You were obligated via contract law to accept the contract based on how it was defined during that process of negotiations, during that mediation process of saying, this is what this line means and this is what this line means. Those clarifications, some people say, well, no, they're not legally binding. Absolutely, in contract law, they are legally binding. You go in front of a judge and you say that this person told me that the Constitution meant this, and this was the hard limit of the necessary and proper clause. The judge says, well, okay, that's your word against his, unless you have it in writing. Voila, you produce it in writing. There's a whole bunch of people that voted on it and so forth. You go, the judge has to overwhelmingly accept that evidence as the empirical data and accept it as the ruling factor, or the factor in making their ruling in favor of that definition of the Constitution. It has to be. There is no other definition that was out there by a proponent for the federal, or the Federalist, or proponent for the Constitution, that made any contrary assertions towards this concept of a limited government, an enumerated constitution, and delegating only very specific powers. This is really that open and shut type of case. So moving forward, as I said yesterday, therefore Madison recognized the point to the contractual standing that the Constitution's true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of ratification was how it was to be defined moving forward. Probably more important to contract maturity and not following these definitions in these documents, enemies of the design of the Constitution, such as John Marshall, such as Alexander Hamilton, and others, thrived on obscuring the ratification debates so that they could spend their career in ambiguity and the farther away from the ratification of the Constitution, the more people forgot the original definitions or those people we call the framers who passed away and died. I want to add something right here. I want you to understand that when people say that that Constitution was a contract between the people and the states, no, people are not a perpetual entity. That's why the contract was done as representatives of the states, representatives of the people as the states. However you want to put it, that is why it was considered a ratification by the state or the people's representatives for the state. It was not done by the people as a democracy. Okay? So this was the beginning of the perversion of the Constitution and what opened the doors for the limited government, or I should say unlimited government, to begin granting itself more and more powers. Technically, it was a limited government, and this is when they began granting themselves more and more powers, such as in the space of creating a national bank. And what they started doing was violating the compact, period. The best part about our problem is that there was never an amendment to allow violations to become legitimate after so long. In other words, there was no such thing as a statute of limitations that the federal government could get away with violating the Constitution for 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, or even 200 years. There was no statute of limitations to make something constitutional. Either it was a violation and will always be a violation until we fix it, or it's in compliance. And so the fact is we have over 85% of what they're spending money on and what they're doing and powers that they're exercising are violations to the Constitution as defined. In addition, there was never an amendment to allow any entity other than the states to delegate power to the federal government. And we see time and time again where the Supreme Court was actually allowing and delegating powers via the court agenda by using rulings and so forth. What this means, that as the states step in and as the states come together, as they unite, as they coalesce, they are the only entity with jurisdiction over all things not delegated to the federal government. We have the problem because of the states not doing their job. In other words, this problem exists because the states never stood up and said, you can't do that. And until this changes, or until we lose the Constitution altogether, like I was saying earlier, the states are the only entities with the authority to clean up this mess by using the process referred to as Republic Review. When one reads the details of the argument and the details of the process, which is available out on reclaimingtherepublic.org, one will recognize how this follows exactly what Madison and Jefferson were attempting in 1798. Now, I'm here to tell you that when Madison and Jefferson jumped out and started calling on these states to join them, in Resolution 8 of both resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia, it is clear, if one really looks at the Kentucky Resolution of 1799, Jefferson was not happy that the other states failed to do their job. Why should he care if he was the only one, or I should say, why should he care if he and the state of Kentucky were only seeking to nullify an unconstitutional law? Why would he care if these other states didn't join? Why would he care if they didn't take a stand? Why even call for a committee of conference and correspondence be appointed? Quote, a, quote, committee of conference and correspondence be appointed, close quote. If he was only out to nullify, then why did he call for these conferences and committees? Or I should say the committees of conference and correspondence. In his resolution of 1799, Jefferson does not pull any punches in stating, we cannot, however, but lament that in the discussion of those interesting subjects by sundry of the legislatures of our sister states, unfounded suggestions and uncandid insinuations derogatory of the true character and principles of the good people of this commonwealth have been substituted in place of fair reasoning and sound argument. And so he's really pointing out that he's lamenting and he's pointing the finger at these states. I'm telling you, folks, if Jefferson was only out to just nullify, he would not have said that comment. He would not have had that paragraph. Why? Because they already successfully did what they needed to do. Why do they care if the other states are living under unconstitutional laws? Because he understood the importance of compliance and obtaining compliance by the federal government in the full capacity of the contract. With that, we're at a hard break. We will be right back after these words. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so let me back up a little bit. I want you to understand that Jefferson's resolutions of 1798 were very clear in identifying the problem, in identifying what had to happen, that the states needed to come together, and that the states needed to be the final arbiter in forcing the federal government back into compliance. He was executing his concept that Madison wrote about in Federalist Paper number 49. Where the states would come together. And in this particular case, instead of it being an appeal from the federal government, this is where the states needed to rally together in addressing this non-compliant federal government. In understanding the relationship, once again, the federal government is the child in this relationship, that the parents are the states. And we had 13, or actually at this point in time, I think 15 states. And so 15 parents. And so you had two parents that were basically trying to call the other 13 parents to join them in getting involved in rebuking and getting the federal government or their child into compliance in the behavior that they expect them to follow per the contract or per the Constitution. So when you read this resolution of 1799, this was Jefferson's response to the other states' insinuations and the other states going, are you kidding me? And I believe this was the huge catalyst. It was the motivator in Jefferson really taking on Adams and the Federalists and fighting them as a political party, as the Republicans, as Jefferson called them, the Democratic Republicans. But in his political addresses, he referred to the party as Republicans. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. They were Republicans. They were not Democrats. As you remember, I think Dr. Vile referred to them as Democrats. If they were Democrats, then why did Martin Van Buren create the Democratic Party in the 20s when they were working to unseat John Quincy Adams in his bid for his reelection? Ironically, it was the Adams, both John and John Quincy, that could not hold the presidency for two terms. Isn't that ironic? Anyway, James Madison, in his report on the Virginia Resolutions, that's what it was called, his report on the Virginia Resolutions in 1800, was clear that he, too, believed the other states failed in stating, and quote, "whatever room might be found in the proceedings of some of the states who have disapproved of the resolutions of the General Assembly of this Commonwealth, passed on the 21st day of December 1798, for painful remarks on the spirit and manner of those proceedings, it appears to the committee most consistent with the duty as well as dignity of the General Assembly to hasten an oblivion of every circumstance which might be construed into diminution of mutual respect, confidence, and affection among the members of the Union. The committee have deemed it more useful task to revise with a critical eye the resolutions which have met with their disapprobation, to examine fully the several objections and arguments which have appeared against them, and to inquire whether they can be any errors of fact, of principle, or of reasoning, which the candor of the General Assembly ought to acknowledge and correct." What he's clearly saying is, hey, you know, we gave you all this facts and data, and it's not like you even, you know, factually refuted this. What they did was they made all sorts of, and just like Jefferson, insinuations and so forth. It bothered Madison so much that he waited a year before he responded. Jefferson in 1799, you know, pretty much responded very quickly. And so Madison, in this report on the Virginia Resolutions, goes on to reaffirm his correctness in the original 1798 resolutions. Clearly, Madison and Jefferson had no intention to simply nullify these laws. If they were, they would have been done. They wouldn't have had to call upon the other states. Anybody that is telling you that they were simply looking for nullification or looking for the other states to nullify, it wouldn't matter. It does not matter if another state nullifies, because you've done it. Your state is good as far as the concept of nullification. You shouldn't sweat whether another state nullifies or not. You're good. And that is the huge point I'm trying to make, that they weren't good. They knew they needed to force the federal government into compliance, and they needed the assistance and cooperation of the other states to take the necessary measures in getting the federal government into compliance. How anybody with, I'm not going to insult anybody, how anybody can go and write a book that it's all about nullification like Dr. Woods and miss these types of things in the analysis of these after reports and so forth and go, how could you just say that that's all they were trying to do? They were literally trying to get the states together to force the federal government. They wanted to interpose period. And that's exactly what Madison and why Madison and Jefferson lamented, why they were disappointed, upset, and even hurt. There's no doubt in my mind Madison was hurt because he actually went into retirement. I don't think he was working in Congress anymore. I think he had completely retired, and when he finally wrote this, his lamentation or his report was when he finally cleared his head and goes, you know, these people just don't get it. These people are clueless as to what they're supposed to be doing. This is their contract. So again, Madison, like I said, in this resolution, goes on to affirm his correctness. Go read it for yourself. He actually goes down the numbers and says, this is clearly a fact. This is a fact. This is what should have happened. Clearly, Madison and Jefferson had no intention to simply nullify these laws. They were looking to rebuke the federal government. At the time of the framing of the Constitution, nullification or nullifying illegal laws was an automatic process. John Marshall referred to this process that the courts, when they recognized that something was not based on the Constitution, it would be declared nullified or void. And if you read the language, it's just it's a simple fact of act, or an act of fact, I should say, that they just do that. That's what they do. And it was common knowledge. The terms null and void were commonly used as an automatic application, not a formal process. If one reads the ratification debates and even the Federalist Papers, one will find the use of both null and void in a few states as standard application, not a formality. The conclusion is academic. If one reviews the macro view of these documents from the ratification debates to the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, they applied the necessary review to identify these acts as null and void and then called upon the states to assert their authority to interpose and rebuke the federal government for going beyond the terms of the compact, or in other words, the Constitution. Anyone, any organization who clings to the nullification concept may not have the capacity to see the macro, or they may be one who has vested interest in relying upon nullification. In other words, they don't care about getting the federal government into compliance. As proven throughout the history of this republic, nullification is equivalent to using a fly swatter to kill an elephant. It is utterly useless, especially with the powers the federal government has assumed over the past 150 years. And now that the fact is that they've got a standing army in every direction in almost every bureaucracy that they have created. This is why, if one is seeking the real solution and not a paper tiger, one will find that trying to formalize nullification is just a red herring. Republic review is the only process that will permanently force the federal government back into the boundaries of the Constitution once and for all. And I will tell you, because I'm almost out of time here, we'll go into some news in the next segment, but I will tell you that if you want to understand this process, and anybody that wants to say anything disparaging, make sure you read the process and listen to what they're saying. If they're not talking about the process, they're talking about my books, they're talking about the concept as it was maturing, then they are obfuscating the truth. And that's what the John Birch Society has been doing to me. And so I just want you to understand that there's a reason why they're not being forthright and honest. It's because they have vested interest in a different alternative, or not fixing the problem, because it's about survival, friends, and it's about relevance. And some organizations are losing their relevance as we fix this problem. We will be right back after a few words. Thank you so much.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
So what do you think? What do you think? Do you think I'm right on this? If you don't think I'm right, if you think that Jefferson and Madison, they were just seeking nullification, that's all a state has to do, and if you want to do it, that's okay. But if not, well, okay, fine. We are going to nullify. We're living with nullification, because nullification is like going to a knife fight with a rubber knife. You're not going to hurt anybody. You're not going to do anything. And as a matter of fact, you're likely going to get hurt yourself or killed. The number to call in, 425-270-5416. If you want to give me your opinion on nullification, if you've completely bought into, I'll just say the imbecility, because any organization that is supporting nullification is really supporting an imbecilic concept, because they are not looking at what Madison and Jefferson did. They're just looking at literally just going to a fight and tickling people and getting them to yell mercy, when that's not going to end up happening. You're going to end up getting shot, stabbed, or what have you, because nobody cares if you're going to try to tickle anybody. They'll just kill you. And so let me kind of get into some marketing for you. And I've said this before, but I want to expound on this, because it seems like the Harriet Tubman $20 bill probe that is moving forward regarding the Treasury Department, they're basically investigating the circumstances that have led to the delay, because they're supposed to start producing a new $20 bill whose portrait belongs to the civil rights activist, if you want to call her that. I don't know if that was... if that's necessarily an appropriate label. I would just say that she was a leader for humanity, right? Why is it a civil rights? Because the context of civil rights means that it's a non-white thing. But civil rights is literally for all. But when they use the context of civil rights, then it means non-white. And I think that that's very exclusive. I think that is not in the spirit of the Constitution and its inclusivity of all people, genders, and so forth, as we have grown in accepting and offering suffrage to all genders and all races. We do not have anything. And as a matter of fact, most of this stuff, some of it is not constitutional, such as, you know, the Civil Rights Act is a non-constitutional act. So let me expound on this, though, because I am a huge supporter of changing the face of our money and getting away from presidents. It's one thing to, you know, have, and as a matter of fact, I think it needs to change on, you know, on a regular clip, maybe 5 years, 10 years. We should not have permanency of Andrew Jackson, permanency of Ulysses S. Grant, permanency of all of these folks who were presidents of the United States, because it was the concept of our republic that we did not have kings, that we didn't have people that stepped into the public fray. You should be, you know, not included. As a matter of fact, we should not have ships named after people of public servants. Public servants were doing their duty to the nation. There's a big difference between a public servant, though, and a leader and or somebody who, you know, went the extra mile. And what I'd like to see is I'd like to see these ships named after, you know, fallen war heroes such as Miles Oviatt in the Civil War, a Marine who received the Medal of Honor in the Civil War. I would like to see us going and naming ships and aircraft and those types of things after people who were not public servants. This McCain crap, Reagan, all of these things. Okay, some were decent public servants. Some of them were terrible, undermining our republic and our rule of law, like McCain. These names should be stripped of these types of edifices, these types of building structures, what have you. Our bills should not have these things. Why? Because this came up right after the beginning of our constitutional republic when Washington was on office, and Hamilton put forth a bill to Congress, and Congress was going to rubber stamp it, that was going to put Washington's face on money and currency. And Madison's argument was, is Washington our king? Because that's commonly what's done in other countries. We need to avoid putting our public servants' faces, names, and likeness on our currencies, our buildings, and so forth. We do not believe in aristocracy, in monarchies, and so forth, that we need to be void of those types of things. And overwhelmingly, Congress agreed. They actually did not vote for that bill, and it was a real poke in Hamilton's eyes. Hamilton was a monarchist. He wanted to see a permanency of the king and something more similar or akin to a king for the United States president. So to be very factual here, we need to go down the path of removing all the presidents from our coins and from our paper, and we need to rotate towards positive contributors. I'm okay with Harriet Tubman. I'm okay with other positive contributors. I'm not okay with people like Dewey, people that were trying to undermine and water down and actually set aside and destroy our Constitution. If this individual was supporting individual liberty and not statism or communism like Dewey and these other idiots, then I believe that we need to be putting those leaders' faces on our currency. We need to name these buildings. I'm not a fan of monuments. The Washington Monument? Absolutely not. I'm not a fan of the Jefferson Memorial. Because these men, it's one thing to have a library and written documents and, you know, a good factual, you know, here are the facts. This is what somebody said. Because you got to remember, anybody that picks up the pen or anybody that sits behind a microphone like myself, we have our biases. We're going to tint, we're going to filter, we're going to apply our own paradigms to what we're trying to say. Even in the academic forum, Even with good old Dr. Vile, because I've read plenty of textbooks, not his, but I've read plenty of textbooks where you'll find in academia, it is obvious that this person who's writing, the person holding the pen, has a very hard slant one way or another. I remember in one of my business management classes, the textbook I read was written by a black activist who felt the United States invented slavery and invented racism. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. What the heck am I having to read here? I shouldn't have to read this type of bias. I mean, it's one, and especially in business. Anyway, let me move forward. But I would just say this, that we need to, again, remove the presidents and start looking at rotating. And I think that there should be, you know, this an open forum where people could submit ideas as to why this person should be the one, you know, the next $1 bill face. I'm okay with those types of things. I'm actually okay with the words "In God We Trust." I'm okay with some of the things that are on there, but the faces and the people have to change. We can no longer just, you know, worship, because it's this, it's tantamount to idolatry. Let me also get into this, because it's obvious that it seems like Virginia is going to be following the course of Oregon. And I think this actually happened in Texas when the Democrats actually checked out of the state legislative sessions and they went to hide. I believe legislatures around the Republic may be doing more hiding, like Oregon, to stop progressive bills that are selling their constituents downriver. Democrats holding of the border, as we understand what's going on downstairs, continues to provide aid and comfort to our enemies, to our Constitution. And so in the focus of the immigration and the problem of why the Democrats are doing this, I honestly believe that we need to start charging these political servants, whether they be the California legislatures, California governor, any public servant that is voting for and providing aid and comfort to people who are violating our Constitution. Those folks are clearly enemies of our Constitution, and we need to punish those who are providing that comfort and aid. We have to. There is, and it's not a matter of hanging them by the, you know, the end of a rope, unless we can prove treason. And I believe we'll find some Congress people guilty of treason. But many of these folks are just doing the party line. They're doing the status quo. And there is enough punishment in the Constitution for them as well. They should be banned for life, their ability to be involved in any public service, period. That is Article, or the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of, again, the 14th Amendment. Go read it. We talk about it a lot. We need to absolutely go after the Dems who are handling the border the way they are, whether they be at the federal level or down at the states, local level. The governor of New Mexico, she should be banned. We should exercise Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and put her butt out of office. If we can prove that she's actually committed treason, then we should go after treason as well. When we come back tomorrow, we will be covering the Declaration of Independence, unfiltered and filtered simultaneously. I think you're going to find this interesting. We will be back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions
donations page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.